Our reading today is from a poem by the one-time poet laureate of the United States, Billy Collins. He calls it, "As If to Demonstrate an Eclipse." And I'm reading it because in this poem, there's this magnificent line at the very end in which Billy Collins says that observing the world and observing what's around him, he just gets more and more cockeyed with gratitude. And what a wonderful thing to be today and every day in any single moment of our lives, cockeyed with gratitude, overwhelmed by joy, so thankful and so grateful it makes our eyes a little googly. What a thing to be. By Billy Collins, As If to Demonstrate an Eclipse. I pick an orange from a wicker basket and place it on the table to represent the sun. Then, down at the other end, I place a blue and white marble that becomes the earth, and nearby I lay the little moon of an aspirin. I get a glass from a cabinet, open a bottle of wine, and sit on a ladder-backed chair, a benevolent God presiding over a miniature creation myth. And I begin to sing a homemade canticle of thanks for this perfect little arrangement, for not making the earth too hot or cold, for not making it spin too fast or slow, so that the grove of orange trees and the owl become possible, not to mention the rolling wave, the peace of clouds, geese in flight, and the Z of lightning striking a dark lake. Then I kick back, I fill my glass again, and give thanks for the trout, the oak, and the yellow feather, singing the room full of shadows as sun and earth and moon circle one another and circle me in their impeccable orbits, and I get, by the moment, more and more cockeyed with gratitude. May it be so. I am actually a rather nervous flyer. Now, I'm not nervous, really, that the plane's going to crash or that terrorists are going to hijack us or something like that. I'm nervous mostly that I am going to mess up and be late for the plane. I'm nervous that I, because of my sheer irresponsibility, which you know must be extreme, my sheer irresponsibility will go and be late for the plane and I will get myself off schedule. I might mess things up for other people and God forbid I may miss a committee meeting. I am so notorious for being excessively early to the airport that I shall truly never live it down. We live 10 minutes from Dulles, and like 2 hours and 45 minutes before my plane is supposed to depart, I will start fidgeting and pacing and complaining and sweating. This is the truth. It's just what I do. It's a part of what it is to be Nancy, and I've been that way pretty much always. Just ask my poor husband who has to put up with it. It's always been that way, except for one time. Just one time. One time in my whole life when I can remember that just for a moment, it didn't matter whether I made it to the plane on time. And yes, friends, it didn't matter if I made it back to the committee meeting at the church I was then serving. It didn't matter if I met my oh-so-pressing schedule. It was a moment that I'll never forget and a moment that I come back to again and again when I need to remember what's really important in life. And this is one of those Sundays when I tell stories on my husband. I always ask permission first because you don't want to do that, you know, out of the blue. This is a story from way back when I had first met John. And at that time, we lived in different time zones. I was in graduate school in Chicago, and John was in graduate school in New Jersey, and the whole thing was not supposed to work because it was just too impractical, and we are thoughtful, practical people. But hey, we thought, why not be impractical for once in our lives? We met in June, and by August, I was on a plane to Newark, New Jersey, nervous and anxious and impatient as I had never been before. I woke up literally at 3:30 in the morning to get to the airport. I wanted to get there so early that I could be sure I wouldn't be nervous, and I could be sure I wouldn't miss the plane, and I could be sure that everything would be in order. I packed and repacked starting 3 days before I left for the trip, and I was hell-bent on organizing this thing to death. It was a real way to begin a relationship, I'm sure. But a long weekend later, at the tail end of that visit, I remember putting my feet up on the dashboard while we drove back to the airport in John's old car. I remember that we were late. Really, really late. I remember checking in at the terminal with all the familiar, dull frenzy of an airport whirling around me, busy people doing busy things. And I remember having the odd feeling that all of those anxious people doing their busy things were on some other planet than I was. Because my world, the world I was in just then, was slower than theirs. And all the things that mattered to them just didn't seem to matter to me right then. I remember when the polite but very nervous lady at the gate told me I had missed my plane, I didn't care at all. I smiled at her and I thanked her for her time, and you'd have thought I gave her 2 dozen roses. I let her know that any flight she could manage for me was just fine, and she looked so relieved. It was the strongest ministry I've ever done. When I sat down in one of those uncomfortable plastic airport chairs to wait for the 3 or 4 or 5 or however many hours I needed to wait, everything that would have shot me full of anxiety on any other day just slid right past me like I was a swimmer in a streamline and the water slid right off my back. I was separated from it all. I was, just for once, above the proverbial fray, beyond the anxiety just for a minute. In a remarkable surge of awareness, I realized that I didn't care if I made it back to the congregation I was working at the time to fulfill whatever agenda item awaited me. I didn't care if I had to sit there for 5 hours. I didn't even care if I had messed up. If I had made a jumble of what could have been a perfectly useful day, I didn't care. And I vividly remember thinking, oh, this must be what love feels like. Oh. And it wasn't just that I was in love with John, although that sure helps. In that moment, I was in love with my life. With the simplicity and joy of little things like feet propped up on a dashboard and songs on the radio. I was in love with that stewardess for being nice to me. I was in love with all those sorry sods running to catch their planes and that stupid plastic chair that I would sit in for 3 unbroken hours of gratitude. I was in love with my life. Not pushing through it, not elbowing my way around it, not making myself feeling guilty about it, not filling myself to the brim with fear about what it might bring, but in love with it. Oh, I thought, this must be what love feels like. Love of a person, of a life. It didn't make itself known in some big dramatic mascara-streaking drama fest. It wasn't hearts and flowers and proclamation of devotion till the end of time. It was me sitting by myself in a really uncomfortable chair for several hours and marveling at the fact that I was purely joyful. I was not reborn into some shiny new life. I was just for a time happy with the one I had. William Wordsworth wrote a poem once about finding God or Jesus, or probably a combination of the two. And he described this state that I'm trying to get across. He described it as surprised by joy and impatient as the wind. Specifically, he said, surprised by joy, impatient as the wind, I turned to share the transport. Oh, with whom but thee, deep buried in a silent tomb, that spot which no vicissitude can find. Well, I do not know really what vicissitude means, though I might have looked it up. Nor do I look for a silent tomb for my transport, but I do understand with everything in me what it means to be both surprised by joy and impatient as the wind. We spend so much of our lives, probably most of mine anyway, in a state of great impatience, longing and planning and guiding ourselves toward the realization of this goal or that. We move through life like bitter passengers in the airport, from one thing to the next, one obligation crowding in on another, each moment full of expectation. The wind that we are alights for a brief time at home cooking dinner or eating alone, then it's gone, fluttering off to the soccer field, the evening meetings, the TV shows of our evenings, and out again to the waiting computer screens, and eventually back into the orbit of the people we love, only to move on, eternally, always headed somewhere else than wherever it is we are right now. Never quite touching or resting or stopping our endless course from this to that. Though our lives are frantic, I think being as impatient as the wind is a state of being that is rather deeper and rather darker than just being overscheduled or having a busy life. Being impatient as the wind is about being ever eager to be somewhere else. It's about being eternally disconnected to the affairs of right now, always longing for some completion that we never wholly grasp, always wishing for something other than this mundane life of dates and times and anxieties. Being impatient as the wind does not just mean being busy. It means never really being anywhere. Always waiting for the answers right around the next corner or the next corner or the next, or the realization of a dream to come when happiness won't be so hard to find. It means never really finding joy in what surrounds us because we're so impatiently waiting for something better. And I understand our impatience. I understand our inability to be where we are because where we are is not always such a great place after all. I've talked to enough of you to know how dark and how confusing this time in your lives and sometimes this time in history can seem to you. For some of us, there is literally a dark cloud of worry and anger that hangs over our days. We can't shake it. We think about how wars don't seem to end and the whole concept of war just is not losing its popularity. About how people all over the world die because we can't see past our own little orbits and into relationship with each other. And on a more mundane but more soul-sucking note, we think about how our own lives just seem so often to be frail and brittle, like a valley of dry bones rattling around in the suburbs. Why would we want to be where we are when our hearts are broken and we're worried about legitimate things to be worried about and there's no great pulsating orb of purpose hanging above us telling us that everything matters and, oh yes, friends, all will be well? Why would we want to be where we are when we're in a valley of dry bones, or an airport waiting room, or a nation at war? Why would we want to be where we are? We wouldn't. We're as impatient as the wind to change it up, to move on, to seek something else that promises some semblance of wholeness in our broken lives in this broken world. But here is the waiting miracle. Here's the magic of it all. See, right in the midst of all of our impatience, right there, right in the middle of all of our desires to be and do and go someplace else, that's where the joy sneaks up on us. Sneaky as a mischievous 5-year-old, quiet as a church mouse, creeping in through the shadows and the muck and the worry and grinning from ear to ear, that's where the joy creeps in. Surprise! Run from me if you will, I will find you. Hide out in your own self-loathing and high expectations if you must, but I won't let you be until you have to sit there, smiling to yourself, and say, finally, oh, that's what it feels like to be in love with my life. Oh. Joy surprises us where we never thought we'd find it. In boring things, in broken things, in early mornings and late nights, in airport waiting rooms and hotel bars and picket lines, and occasionally when we are oh so lucky in church, it catches us by surprise. Even though we are the most impatient creatures imaginable, joy sneaks up on even us. And then we find ourselves, as Billy Collins says, cockeyed with gratitude before a world where beauty has been waiting patiently right in front of us while we tried so dang hard to find it someplace else. So often we are trained to see the world for all that it could be, for all that better be better about it. But when we let ourselves receive the waiting gift of joy, then we live for just a time in gratitude, thankful for all that is right now. One of my friends recently did something I've always wanted to do. He went to Rome, and he went into the Sistine Chapel, and he stood there and he stared at the big painting on the ceiling. And when my friend got back from Rome, he told me that he thought of me while he was in the Sistine Chapel, which made me feel very fabulous, because I'm worldwide now. But actually, what he thought of there in the Sistine Chapel was not me at all. It was a sermon that I had long forgotten I had ever preached, and he reminded me of my own words. See, the sermon that I totally forgot was a reflection on the central image in that fresco. You all know it. It's that famous image where God's finger and Adam's finger are about to touch, but they never quite do. That space between them, everything and almost nothing at the same time. My friend reminded me of my own deep wisdom when he told me about how I had preached a sermon about how in that famous image, God is doing all of the work. God's finger is positively straining. God is reaching as far as he can with all the force that God can muster, and you can tell because the wind is blowing in his big white beard. And he stretches forth his finger with all of his might, trying to touch this other, this Adam, this young man who lolls on his elbow in Eden like some college student on a futon, trying to sleep over Saturday night's hangover. You know, it's just this Adam who's just laying there, and he's all slumpy, and he looks half asleep. And his effort is almost non-existent. It's like this, that image. God is reaching mightily, and Adam is just chilling out. And I like to think that I understand exactly what Michelangelo is trying to say. While maybe it's not this billowing, white-bearded God who reaches out to us so mightily, maybe something does. Joy, beauty, blessing, abundance, they all reach out to us with a force that is almost unimaginable. Each blossom on each tree, each stranger on the sidewalk, each child's laugh and each rain-soaked morning are all bursting with beauty, waiting for us to get with the game and notice, waiting for us to allow the abundant joy available all around us to creep into our dry bones and fill us up with gratitude. Joy is reaching out to us, stretching fingers of light and laughter in our direction, straining with sheer force, and too often we are lolling like Adam, lost in our worries, our fears, our self-obsessions, blah, blah, blah. Unable to raise our own fingers just a little bit to the beauty that surrounds us. But joy is reaching. It never stops reaching. It doesn't mean that our broken hearts and our world at war and all of the real worries that hover over us aren't real. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't be concerned or that we shouldn't make an effort to make it to the airport on time, or that everything is going to be sunshine and happiness in our lives. The reality and availability of joy once known doesn't fix everything. It just colors everything around it, including our sorrow. Once we let joy pierce our hearts often enough, we weep not because we are bitter and angry about the world and how crappy it is, but because we know what it is to have felt joy and we want it to be available to more people more often. Everywhere. We don't work for justice out of despair. We work for justice because we love something so much it's worth saving. Joy reaches out, and we are more than equipped to change the world and ourselves if we just reach back. I am still freakish about getting to the airport early. Not even a moment of great revelation will change that. I still pace and fret and get all impatient, and I do not spend all my days blissed out and overcome by joyfulness just because I know what it is to be in love. Trust me, the husband with whom I share such love can attest to those truths. But I will tell you that some little part of me sees that place, the buzzing energy of a frantic airport, that particular worry in a different light. I don't give it so much power because I've known what it felt like to be surprised by joy, a joy that washed away my impatience. Those moments are rare for me, but they are real. All I have to do, all we have to do, is accept them and remember and never let ourselves forget what it is to know joy reaching so powerfully for us. We live in this world surprised by joy, impatient as the wind. Let us stop from time to time and let the reality of our great blessedness seek into our tiny, dry bones and fill us up, bringing all that we are grateful for, all that has blessed us, into that valley of dry bones until we are whole and joyful and abundant again. Blessed be and Amen.